expect to do.
I'm going to just kind of kick things off, and Dick, you're our local here today, being from Lubbock. Lubbock's a place I love to be able to visit. The weather, geography is so much different than my own home state, but that creates challenges for you probably in terms of crop production.
It certainly does, Alan. Once you go west of here, and you didn't see this during your tour here, but it comes all about the water. And so our program at Lubbock, Texas, which is funded jointly by Texas Tech and the Texas A&M University through the Texas AgriLife Association, has concentrated on those plants that can be grown in marginal sites, either because they're too dry or they have impaired water, too salty to sustain other crops. And what we'd like to do is to move our cropping west toward California and start to use some acreage in the far western United States to produce biodiesel feedstocks.
Now, what are some of the crops that you're working with right now?
The two crops that we've worked out most recently, of course, is winter safflower, okay. And it's kind of a new development, one of the most drought-hardy crops grown. And the other crop that we've worked with is castor. Many of you will remember castor because your grandmother chased you around with a spoon of it and said, this will make you feel better, and it didn't.
So castor, what I know about castor, it's one of those crops which has challenging times in terms of some of the breeding that goes with it, and it's a ricin levels. There's something that sometimes causes concern with folks.
Yes, at my station there in Lubbock, I hate to hear on the news there's been a ricin incident, because I'm going to get to see my FBI agents locally there. I know my name now. At least twice that day. They're going to be there at 8:30, make sure I came to work and don't have a turban on my head. And they're going to make sure that I reported for duty and all my ricin is accounted for.
Yeah, and you're serious too, right?
I'm serious.
Yeah, I don't think it's not a joke.
And they're really worried about that ricin.
So water's a big issue for you. Mary, I know that water comes up all the time in your industry in terms of the production of algae.
Absolutely, water does come up. The key with algae, though, it uses non-potable water. And so we can use waste stream water, we can use marine salt water to grow algae. And so it's not, fresh water is not an issue. It's really utilizing water that actually has nutrients in it in order to grow the algae.
I think that's one of the neatest things, attending the conference that you put on every year. There was lots of discussion about wastewater treatment facilities, animal livestock operations. Basically, mm-hmm. any generator of wastewater, especially those with nutrients, would be an ideal spot for algae production.
Oh, absolutely. Co-location is actually really critical and key. And so we were looking at co-location, whether that be by a dairy facility, a large dairy facility. I visited several just actually last month in Phoenix. Looking at by a wastewater treatment facility, looking at an energy facility. And so that whole co-location piece, particularly because of the CO2 gas availability and the nutrient availability, makes it very symbiotic.
So anaerobic digestion would be a good thing to be co-located.
Absolutely.
With, in that case. Excellent. Dave, I told you backstage how happy I was to have you with us. So Dave represents the biodiesel production side of the equation. I said, now keep us honest. We're going to talk about all these feedstocks. So, how does it all work? So we've talked about castor, we've talked about algae so far. Any issues you see in terms of existing biodiesel facilities and handling these feedstocks?
Well, that's a good question, because really the two challenges are getting the feedstock and then making something that meets spec and meets our customers' requirements. So most feedstocks can be pre-treated or refined to the point where they can be made into biodiesel. And I would say all can, but somebody will come up with something someday that can't really. But there's always going to be challenges with that. So I think for the biodiesel industry, one of the real focuses has to be on preparing the oil or fat to meet the specs that are needed to make biodiesel out of it. And there's various ways people have gone about that. But at Renewable Energy Group, we've been really focused for a long time on making biodiesel from any feedstock we can get our hands on. So what that led us to is a lot of animal fat, waste oils. We'd love to get Mary's algae oil and Dick's castor, which we can use in small amounts. Castor has some issues, as we can talk about. I actually brought some feedstock samples that Dick's holding a castor biodiesel that we made as part of a feedstock study that we did. Mary has one of our two algae biodiesels we made. Dallas has sunflower, because that's a good roadside crop. And I'm holding an animal fat representative here. We have choice white grease biodiesel made from pork fat. So really, we're kind of the scavengers of the biodiesel world. We're not an integrated company. We don't have soybean crush nearby, so we're looking to make biodiesel from everything we can. And fortunately for us, there's a lot of oil out there and fat that doesn't really have other good uses. And so we feel that we're doing a valuable service by taking these feedstocks that may not have a good commercial home and our byproducts, really. of the other industries.
Dave, you actually brought us right into some of the work that Dallas is working on. So I think you have a sunflower, isn't that what you brought? And so Dallas works on the Freeway to Fuels program. So you're agnostic in terms of feedstocks, anything that'll grow. But why don't you, the rest of the group may not know all the details in terms of how that was formed. Give us the 30-second version.
Sure.
For those of you that know Dallas, asking him to speak for 30 seconds, just that's an oxymoron somewhere along the way. But try.
I'm sorry. We'll give it a shot here. Basically, what we're doing is looking at a new paradigm in biofuel feedstock production, and that is areas that are maintained currently and that are non-traditional in agronomic situations. And so basically, the first one we looked at was the roadsides, and we termed the project Freeways to Fuel. So we figure there's somewhere around 10 million acres out there along our roadsides that we could be more sustainably using rather than just mowing grass. Here in the state of Texas, you mow 1.7 million acres of grass every year to a tune of $26 an acre. So we could produce right here in the state of Texas fairly easily 100 million gallons of biodiesel.
What are some of the crops you've worked with? I know you've worked with Sun a little bit, and you've worked with SAF, right?
We have a national coalition, and so there are different people around the country at land-grant universities that are trying this method. And sunflower was actually planted in North Carolina this last year in 2009. Dr. Matt Veal there with the Ag Engineering Department. And we are looking at any oilseed crop that is out there and available and with climatic conditions appropriate. So some of the things that we have tried in Utah, which is going to be the low end of the growing scale compared to the abundant resources east of the Rockies, are canola, safflower, camelina, and flax. Those are all high desert, basically if they'll grow in Utah, they'll grow anywhere type plants.
So we were actually chatting yesterday, and Dave told me that your firm has done a wide study in terms of a lot of various feedstocks, and so I was kind of running through a list, and you've worked with castor and algae, obviously. Have you worked with Jatropha?
Yep.
Most of the animal fats?
Yeah, I'd say all of them.
Yeah, moringa?
Yes, we made moringa biodiesel.
How about the chicken fat tree?
Ah, sorry, you got me there.
it's an interesting tree crop that is pretty much an invasive species in parts of the southeast. And so I was working hard trying
it's
to
endangered
find
too,
at least one.
Yeah, it may be an endangered species.
The other thing I was listening to Ann Frick speak, and she was laying herself out there, and she was giving you some forecasts and some ideas of what she thought. So backstage, I was like, okay, we can't be outdone. So I gave him a little bit of forewarning. I said, I want you to make a prediction. And go ahead and be bold if you're willing. So I'm going to kind of throw it open to the group here in terms of any predictions you have in terms of some of the feedstocks or programs that you work with. And whoever wants to
All right,
to
I'll jump in there. I will predict that within 2 years, biodiesel largely will be sold and marketed based on its cloud point and other properties, possibly sustainability score. Right now, everybody's used to seeing biodiesel as SME or canola methyl ester or tallow methyl ester. I think that that's going to go away as we get into this area where everybody's using everything they can run, and it's no longer feasible to specify feedstock. You're going to specify your cloud point. If you've got a sustainability target to hit, maybe you'll specify that, and that's how biodiesel is going to be marketed.
Interesting. So hold that thought, Dallas. I know you're getting ready to jump in. When you talk about if it's sold on cloud point or sustainability, are you talking about then that it's going to be single feedstocks?
Why I'm saying that it's going to be mixed feedstocks. It's going to be something that meets the specs of the customer, meets the sale that they need. And if they have I'm just throwing sustainability in there because that's becoming a big concern for a lot of our customers.
So do you think will that blending occur of the feedstocks before production, or do you think it's going to be the blending of the finished product?
It'll go both ways. At REG, we like to do whatever we have to so we can blend them up front or we can blend them downstream. There'll be a lot of blending, I think, from multiple suppliers as well in the big distribution system. So,
and what did you say? You said 2 years?
2 years.
2 years.
Two
okay.
years, no more feedstock specification.
I'm going to go a little higher than that. I don't think Freeways to Fuels in its infancy, but I think we have tremendous capacity. And I think Joe has challenged me, put me down on the score sheet for 100 million gallons that I have to contribute to the industry. I think within 5 years, realistically, we can have 50 million gallons coming out of these feedstocks. That's going to be my prediction. Is we'll be halfway there in 5 years. That will be sustainably grown biofuel feedstock of your choice that grows in your climate.
Well, the number one question that I get all the time, particularly from the media, from policymakers in Washington, is, when will algae be commercialized? talking to our members, talking to our member companies, ranging from the Sapphires to Solenzymes to the Solexes, I really expect full-scale commercialization in the next 3 years at a reasonable price and particularly focused to the jet fuel industry.
That's 3 years.
That's bold.
That's great.
That's good.
And I know that that's probably the biggest
question. And I know there's some in the bag. So.
I need some more questions because that's what all these were, was when's algae going to be commercialized? So.
She already
3 years.
Yeah, exactly.
We did a land survey, and 7 western states, including the western part of Texas, contain nearly 600 million acres. The federal government controls over 200 million acres of that. So I took Dallas's theory about growing it alongside the roadway and jumped over the fence and said, we need to find agricultural lands that we can bring into production in a sustainable manner and not destroy the ecology or the sustainability of the thing. But we have to produce biodiesel feedstocks in the western U.S. And so I suspect that within a reasonable time, in 5 years, I'm more conservative maybe than she is, within 5 years, we could have production on maybe 20 million acres that would produce anywhere from 1 to 1.6 billion gallons of biodiesel a year.
I like it. We'll see where we go. We actually have a couple of questions here, which I think are going to be pretty good. And I'm gonna address this to Dick yourself as well as Dave, because I think the two kind of go together. The question was, can castor oil really be a biodiesel feedstock that meets ASTM because of the hydroxyl fatty acid that's attached to it? So I think, and I'm going to add to the question and combine it with both the processing side because of the hydroxyl, and then also what you might be doing to address the ricin issue.
Well, yeah, the hydroxy acid in castor is an issue. It could be an issue just with the specification for biodiesel at ASTM. However, castor does have some interesting properties because it has a really low cloud point. It's at a high viscosity. So I think right away it could be used in small quantities as potentially a cloud point depressant or a small portion of a biodiesel that's made now. But I do think unless some changes are made at ASTM that the hydroxy acid would have to be addressed. And the people to do that are... one of them sitting right over here. So, Dick, what do you think about that?
Well, I agree wholeheartedly with. I'm about the biggest thief I know. And so I search for ideals wherever I can find them. And when it comes to renewable fuels, I look to Brazil. And Brazil said, we're going to use our soybean oil crop for export. And we're going to use our castor crop, and they're one of the third largest producers of castor oil, for biodiesel. And so I trusted them and wandered off into this wilderness of castor oil. And castor oil makes a pretty bad biodiesel, okay? And we got caused this hydroxy group. And so in our own program and in Brazil, we've had a look at hydrogenating that oil to tie up that hydroxyl group. And if we don't do that, you can't see this from where you're at, but this is 3 times more viscous than rosemary's or any of these other biodiesel here. And that's troubling. Brazil's working frantically on doing this, but we have hydrogenated oils and fats for many years. One of the questions that came up yesterday to a gentleman I was talking to, he says, well, isn't that going to create a trans fat? He's absolutely right. 50% trans, 50% cis. But I don't think an engine cares.
I would agree with that. The engine does not mind the trans fat, so your body may differ.
When the engines start building up cholesterol, we've got problems.
Can I ask a question? We're working pretty hard on the breeding it. I know you're a breeder, and so tell us a little bit about the breeding that's going on with castor.
That's really exciting. I took a trip to Brazil and hired all the students I could find down there and brought them back up here. I'd been working since 1994 trying to reduce the ricin content. The ricin is a game stopper. It really is. I get along fine with my FBI agents, but you don't need that kind of acquaintances in your life. And so we're releasing this next year a variety called Brigham. It's named after Ray Brigham, who's one of the early genetic pioneers in castor, and it has a 90% reduction in ricin. While that's good, me and my FBI agents agreed 99% would be better.
Let's switch to a different question, and this is for Mary. And it comes back to algae, not just in terms of timeliness, but in terms of production right now. Where are some of the largest algae projects in terms of either companies or locations here in the U.S.?
Well, we can talk to several of those. I'm sure many of you are aware of the consortium that was being led by the Danforth Group out of St. Louis. We also know most of the national labs, Sandia, NREL, Pacific National Laboratories, Los Alamos are all working on algae projects. That being said, in the private sector, you know, key companies that are very well, if not at commercialization, very close to commercialization include Sapphire, Aurora Biofuels, Live Fuels, Solix, Solazyme, BioNavita, Smartech, Targeted Growth. Most of our members are well-funded and at that close to or if not at that commercialization phase. I know Solazyme, for example, announced a contract, a $9 million contract with the DOD in September as far as supplying fuels to the Department of Defense. So those are some of the bigger algae projects that I can talk to.
Okay.
There's been several test flights with Boeing and Airbus that are utilizing algae as jet fuels.
Let me see if I can squeeze one more question in here. I'm at Dallas. Basically, one of the members of the audience asked, and anybody can fill in at the end, is one feedstock more sustainable than another? And I know you really got into the Free Water Fuels program because of sustainability.
Exactly.
And so is one feedstock more sustainable than others?
Let's go right off the top and look at the carbon footprint that we're putting into the roadsides now. Okay. So anything that we get out of that in terms of a biofuel would increase the sustainability of any crop, whether it be the grass growing there, if we can somehow, you know, use that. But oilseed crops, they generally go, the lowest input one would be the camelina, and then the safflower, and then you go up to the canola in terms of fertility inputs, insecticides, pesticides, those types of things. So actually, the camelina breeding program at Montana State and other private companies has come a long ways, and we're going to re-enter the camelina back into our trials with some new genetics, and hopefully even increase that sustainability score more.
I said it was the last question, but it just dawned on me that just recently I saw a study that came out that actually looked at the sustainability of algae, but it wasn't necessarily real favorable that came out.
What you're referencing is the University of Virginia study by Andre Clarence as the associate professor there. We actually, as an association, took a bit of different view on that study. There's a couple points. First of all, it was shown as a life cycle assessment. From my bioplastics days, I spent the last 5 years in bioplastics and spent a lot of time being in front of the NRDC and the EDF and Walmart, Starbucks and others, defending life cycle analysis. So the first part of this is it really wasn't a true life cycle analysis. A life cycle analysis goes from cradle to grave, and this assessment actually only went from cradle to factory gate. It didn't take into consideration the back end. What was the product going to be used for? What was the biomass going to be used for? So it didn't take in any of the CO2 sequestration that could come back and change that whole life cycle analysis. So we call it semantically an eco profile. The other piece is, and this is an issue with the algae industry. There's a lot of intellectual property in the algae industry right now that's very, very protected and quiet. Because of that, the data that was utilized was more than 10 years old. I talked about my good friend John Benneman, who is just a leader in algae. And unfortunately, you know, John has been in this industry for 50 years. And so we have to just look at some of the data and what has been used, because some of the new data, the new technologies, the new innovation, the new creativity, the new pieces were not incorporated.
Excellent. I wish that we had another 30 minutes or an hour just to keep going, but we have a program that is great to be able to finish up with us today. So just a quick rehash. In 2 years, we're going to blend feedstocks.
Everybody's going to be feedstock agnostic, yep.
I like it.
50 million in 5 years.
We're going to take federal lands and we're going to start growing crops.
Five years.
There we go. And commercial production of algae.
And
in
true
years.
Commercialization of algae.
Okay.
Absolutely.
I sincerely appreciate having everybody to be with us today. And I wish we had 30 more minutes to go. So if we could just show them a little bit of appreciation. Thank you very much.